Okay, we're beginning here with the Mishnah on the top of Kuf Vav Amud Aleph. The Mishnah begins B'Siman Avu Meitzarav. If the Mocher, the seller, says to Lokeach, I'm selling you this field, and these are its demarcations, these are its borders. The way that the Rabbeinu Gershom expresses, as well as the Rav Shbam, is a case of Hera'alo HaMocher LeLokeach. The seller showed him the property, and in the process of showing the property, he says, these are its demarcations, these are its borders. And so what the Mocher said to the Lokeach was the following, Beit Kur Afar, B'simanavo Meitzarav Ani Mocher Lecha. I am selling you a Beit Kur Afar, here are its demarcations, here are its borders, Ve'aralo. And then he showed him the property, or while he's saying this, he's showing him the property. Then in that case, Pachot Mishtut, if the deviation from the Beit Kur Afar that he's supposed to sell him is less than 1/6, Higiyo, the transaction goes through. So that's whether there's too much land, meaning it's an excess of a Beit Kur Afar, or whether there's too little land, it's less than a Beit Kur Afar. As long as the deviation's within a 1/6, Higiyo, the transaction goes through. Ad Shtut here is read as the way that Rashbam says it is, if it's 1/3 the deviation, 1/4, 1/5, until 1/6, if the deviation is above, obviously, 1/6, yinakeh, then you deduct it from the price. The truth is that it really only shows you one of the two directions, which is in the case where he gave him less land than he was supposed to give, then the seller has to deduct from the price for the buyer. What happens in the situation where he gives him excess karka, but it's more than a 1/6 deviation? Over here, the Rashbam says that in that case, v'motir yachzir lo akarka. If there was an excess above the Beit Kur Afar, then he gives back the excess land. Now, that's the Rashbam's view. Many Rishonim say, you know, if he is above the amount, above that 1/6, not like the Rashbam says where you return the land until you get down to a Beit Kur Afar, but rather then that sends us back to the previous Mishnah, where when the Mocher overgave in property, there were rules about that, depending on how much land there was. Over here, the guidelines are a Shtut. But once you cross over that level, then depending on how much land that is in its entirety, 1/6 of a Sa'ah turns out to be a Kav, because we remember we said that Rova Kav Lisa'ah meant 1/24. As the Rashbam says over here, it's Kiflei Kiflaim, it's 4 times the amount. Or in essence, if you put 4 over 24, you get 1/6. And that is a Kav, because there's 6 Kav in a Sa'ah. So therefore, it would be a Kav per Sa'ah. If you're selling a Beit Kur Afar, then 1/6 would be 30 Sa'ah times the 1 Kav would leave you with 30 Kav. And that is way in excess of the 9 Kav that we saw before. That's the minimum amount for a field. So in a Beit Kur Afar, everybody would agree that you give back the land to the Mocher. On the other hand, if it is less than the 9 Kav or the delineations that we gave in the previous Mishnah, there are many Rishonim, unlike the Rashbam, will believe that he doesn't give back the Karka, but rather it's the choice of the Mocher, whether the Lokeach pays more money, or he gives him back the karka. Although what is clear from our mission over here is that the demarketing line is a shtut and not the rova akav l'sa'ah that we saw in the previous mishnayot. Now why do we have a shtut over here? So shtut is familiar to us from the sukyot of ona'ah in Baba Metzia, but the only problem is here, we're not talking about ona'ah. And that's what the Rashbam says over here, that the high shtut la mishum din ona'ah, that this shtut has nothing to do with the din of ona'ah, Din ona'ah lo metaltalei, because there's no din of ona'ah by metaltalim, of a makarkei ain ona'ah. But when it comes to karkaot, there is no din of ona'ah. Now, this sends us back to the sugya back on Kuf Gimel Amud Bet, and there the Rashbam asked a similar question with regards to the midah bechevel. If someone gives exact delineations of the midah, doesn't Rova say that the din is, there is ona'ah there, even pachot mishtut, and therefore, why was the mission over there saying that you return the money, or you pay a little extra, why wasn't the whole mekach batel? So the Rashbam, the Shitato over there, says that only applies to metaltalin, not to mikarke, doesn't apply to karkaot. And similarly over here, the Rashbam is saying that this din of ona'ah is not applicable over here, because that's a din in metaltalei, it's not a din in karkei. But if you really believe that this Mishnah, Simanava Meitzarav, is the equivalent of Midah Mishkal Minyan, it's not clear that's the case, but Midah Bechevel, that's clear over here, maybe it means the same thing. If you demarcate it exactly where the boundaries are, then maybe that is an exact delineation, and therefore there should be a din of Ona'ah over here. If that's the case, then the Rashbam, like back on Kuf Gimel, Amud Bet, believes that there's no ona'ah by karkot, even when you give exact measurements. Others, like the Bali et Tosafot over there, say that that din is only applicable when they measured and did everything exactly prior to the transaction. But where the transaction goes down before the measurements are done, then it doesn't have application. Another Rishonim over there we discussed suggested that Mida Mishkal Uminyan is only a problem when the particular number makes the utility or changes the utility of the item. By Karka, where the utility is all the same across the board, there's no din of Mida Mishkal Uminyan. So if you believe that this is a case of Mida Mishkal Uminyan, then you would have to use the same answers we gave before on Kuf Gimel Amud Bet. If you believe that this isn't the case of Mida Mishkal Uminyan, then the Reshbam's answer over here, that there is only Ona'ah by Metaltalin and I by Karkaot, therefore the Shtut that is being mentioned or spoken about here cannot be a derivative of the Din of Ona'ah. And therefore the Reshbam explains over here that the Shtut is really a Din Derabonon, an assumption of the Rabonon that people are Mochel up to a sixth. And that is bringing balance to what was said over here in the Mishnah. The person articulated the sale in the following manner, Beit Kur Afar. So that means that I'm supposed to give you a Beit Kur Afar. On the other hand, he said, Simanavu Meitzarav. These are the borders. And as the Rashbam points out, that is the equivalent of saying to him, Sadezo, that this field, Kevan De'Ralo HaMitzarim Kamanda Zavin Le Sadezo Stama. It's as if he's saying, this field. And when you say this field, Magio, whether it's big or small, the person sees the field, you've identified the field, then it goes to him no matter what the size and what the nature of the field is, because he knows exactly what he is getting. But because he also phrased it not only just saying Meitzarav is Simanav, but he said Beit Kur Afar, so then that adds a dimension to it that he's indicating that it has to be somewhere near a Beit Kur Afar. And so the Chachamim found a balance between the statement of Beit Kur Afar, which would seem to indicate an exact Beit Kur Afar. On the other hand, he's saying this field, and so they found the balance to be 1/6, and in the Gemara itself we'll see some indications of that, that generally when you make assessments of property, then up to a 6th is considered to be a natural deviation, and that's why we allow the transaction to go through when it is a 6th. So that's the Rashbam's explanation for the 6th over here, that it's really a Din Derabonon that's telling us that people have Mechila up to that point, and it's balancing between the Beit Kur Afar, which stam means hein chaser, hein yeter, means more or less the Beit Kur Afar, versus sadezu, which is that it's exactly this field. So then, Beit Kur Afar, hein chaser, hein yeter, you're allowed to rove a kav of deviation. Sadezu, you get exactly what you get. There's no questions about size or how it matches up with size. So the balance between them, he says, is this area of 1/6, which the Rabbanan determined to be the level of mechila that people have. That's the explanation of the Mishnah according to the Rashbam and most of the Rishonim. The Rimi Gash over here has a very interesting explanation of the Mishnah. The Rimi Gash in general in this sugya seems to deviate from all the other Rishonim in explaining many of the aspects. And over here he says that the case here of Bisimanavu Meitzarav is the equivalent to what we've seen in the previous Mishnayot. In the previous Mishnayot we saw when the person articulates Beit Kur Afar ani mocher lecha mida bechevel, Beit Kur Afar amer ani mocher lecha hein chaser hein yeter. So one of them was exact by the measure, the other one meant more or less. And now there's another expression according to the Rimi Gash, which is bisimanavu meitzarav, that I'm selling you a Beit Kur Afar bisimanavu meitzarav. It's not a case where he showed him the property. It's not a case where he showed him the boundaries or anything like that. This is an expression which says I'm giving you a Beit Kur Afar bisimanavu meitzarav. And what the Rimi Gash says is, this language falls between the other two languages, which is that the language of Mida Bechevel means exactly a Beit Kur Afar. On the other hand, Beit Kur Afar hein chaser hein yeter meant more or less, and that allowed you a deviation of Rov HaKav L'Sa'ah, or 1/24. Over here, he says that B'tzimanavu Meitzarav, and therefore it is a stronger language than hein chaser hein yeter, which means that he's looking for something more exact than more or less. On the other hand, he has allowed for a little deviation. He didn't say Mida Bechevel. And therefore, it sits between them. And the way that the Rimi Gash is reading it is that the Shtut here is not 1/6, like we were reading it, 1/6 of the total sale or the total amount being transacted upon, but rather a Shtut of a Kav, 1/6 of a Kav. So as opposed to the previous Mishnah that said it's a quarter a Kav L'Sa'ah, he's saying it's 1/6 of a Kav L'Sa'ah, or in essence, it's 1/36 is the deviation that we would allow. And therefore, you have three different levels. You have Mida Bechevel, which says it's got to be exact. Hein Chaser Vehein Yeter, which allows for a deviation of 1/24. And then there's a language of Simanavu Meitzarav that allows for a deviation of 1/36, which sits between the case of Mida Bechevel and Hein Chaser Vehein Yeter. And that's the way that the Rimi Gash reads the Mishnah. But obviously, then, for him, Pichet Mishtut, if it was less than 1/6 of a Kav, meaning that the deviation was less than 1/6 of a kav per sa'ah, higio. Ad shtut, meaning that it was more than 1/6 of a kav, all the way to 1/6 of a kav, inakeh. In that case, you would have to then refund the money, or return the karka, depending on where the deviation was. Now, the Gemara deals with an issue, which is that our Mishnah is not clear about what the din of a shtut is. The Mishnah says if it's less than a shtut, the din is such and such. If it's ad a shtut, meaning that if it's greater than a shtut till a shtut, then the din is that you have to refund or return the karka. But what about a sixth itself? That is not defined by the Mishnah, and that's the machloket amoraim that we're about to see. Itmar Rav Huna Amar, shtut ke pachot mishtut. According to Rav Huna, 1/6 is the equivalent of less than a sixth. Rav Huna Amar, shtut ke yoter mishtut. Shtut is like greater than a shtut. Or in essence here, they're arguing about whether we say ad ve'ad bichlau or ad velo ad bichlau. So when the second half of the Mishnah says ad the shtut until a sixth, I mean you're coming from higher numbers down to a shtut, does that mean ad shtut velo ad bichlau, and therefore only above a sixth has this din, but a sixth doesn't have this din? That's Rav Huna's position. On the other hand, Rav Yehuda believes that it is ad ve'ad bichlau. So when it says ad shtut, it means including a shtut, the din will be such, and therefore a shtut has the same din as greater than a shtut, which is that you have to refund the money. And now the Gemara will help us to read the Mishnah according to each of their positions. Rav Huna Amar shtut kepachot mishtut hachi kamar. This is how you read the Mishnah. Pachot mishtut ushtut bichlal higio. That whether it's less than a shtut or a shtut itself, that's included in higio that the mekach is kayam. Yoter mishtut, if it's greater than a shtut, meaning it's greater than 1/6, inakeh. Rav Yehuda, on the other hand, will read the Mishnah as Amar shtut kiyoter mishtut hachi kamar. This is how you would read the Mishnah. Pachot mishtut higiyo. If it's less than a sixth, the transaction goes through. Ad ashtut ushtut bichlal inake. And until a shtut, meaning coming from higher numbers down to a shtut, including a shtut, then you would refund the money or refund the karka, depending on what the situation is. And he would read it as ad vi ad bichlal. Meitevei. This is a question on Rav Huna, who says that the shtut does not have a din like yoter mishtut. That shtut has a din like pachot mishtut. Because the Braita says, Bisimanav umeitzarav. If he uses the language like our Mishnah says, or the case is similar to our Mishnah, pichet shtut, ohotir shtut. If it's less than a sixth, or greater than a sixth, arihu kishuma dayanim, it has the same din as shuma dayanim, and higiyo, and it goes to him. So now over here, where he uses pichet shtut, ohotir shtut, that's talking about the deviation away from whatever measurement they were using. So if it was a sixth less than whatever they used, or it was a sixth greater than whatever demarcation or midah that they used, hayuk shuma dayanim higiyo. Vaha shuma dayanim. When we deal with the assessments of Beit Din, over here we're speaking about a Beit Din that is coming to assess the property of an estate in order to liquidate parts of the estate to pay for the expenses of the estate. For instance, they have to pay for the food of the almana. They have to pay for the food of the banot. They set up an auction in order to auction off the property. When they auction off the property, we allow over there a certain amount of deviation from the fair market price of the property. So there it says it's the same shtut that is used as the demarcating line to determine whether it's within the range of normal variation or whether it's an excessive type of variation. And by shuma danayim, the shtut kiyoter mishtudu, over there by shuma danayim, if it's 1/6, it has the same din as greater than 1/6, which means that by shuma danayim, if they exceed the amount by a sixth or they are less than the amount by a sixth, that's already considered to be bitul mekach, similar to more than a sixth in problems of bitul mekach. So you see by shuma dayanim that a sixth has the same din as being greater than a sixth, and that would be supportive of Rav Yehuda's position over here, and a problem for Rav Huna, because over there, the Braita seems to compare the din of our Mishnah, v'misimanav v'meitzarav, to shuma dayanim. And by shuma dayanim, it's clear that the shtut has the same din as yoter mishtut. So now Rav Huna says back, Amar lecha Rav Huna, uletameich higiotani. Wait a minute. In that Braita, it says higio, that the conclusion is that you get to keep it. So he says, there's a problem already in the Braita, because the Braita is saying it's like Shuma Dayanim. And if you're telling me it's like Shuma Dayanim, by Shuma Dayanim, it should be that a sixth has the same din as greater than a sixth, which is Bito Mekach. Yet the Braita says that Pichet Shtut, Otir Shtut, higio, it stays intact. The whole transaction stays intact. So now it seems that there's an internal stira in the Braita itself, which is that it's telling you it's like Shuma Dayanim, it's telling you that's higio. Ella. So we're going to read the Gemara now like the Balei HaTosafot. This is the Girsa that the Balei HaTosafot bring down, which means that this is a continuation of Rav Huna's answer. It's explicating on his reasoning as to how to explain the Braita in his Shita. The Rishbam also brings that alternative similar girsa that he found in other Sfarim, which is the girsa of the Balei Tosafot, and what we have in our Gemara, which is Ela Kishuma Dayanim, Velo Kishuma Dayanim. What the Braita is saying is, it's similar to Shuma Dayanim in some ways, and it's not like Shuma Dayanim in other ways. Kishuma Dayanim Lishtut. It is similar to Shuma Dayanim in the fact that 1/6 is used as the threshold for determining whether this is a variance that is normal, or that it's a variance that is excessive. Or in essence, it's coming to tell us that this din is separate from the dinim of the previous Mishnah. The previous Mishnah used Rova Kaav the Sa'ar 1/24. Our Mishnah is saying that the demarcation is a shtut, and that's the comparison to Shuma Dayanim. The assessment of a property, both in this situation as well as the situation of Shuma Dayanim, 1/6 is the proper threshold to use. Veloka Shuma Dayanim, but it's not exactly similar to Shuma Dayanim. Ilhotam batomekach. Ilhocha igiyo. On the other hand, it's not like Shuma Dayanim, because over there, by Shuma Dayanim, a sixth is like greater than a sixth, and there's bitomekach. On the other hand, by us, a sixth has the same din as pachot mishtut, and higiyo, and the transaction stands. So that's the way that you would explain it according to the Balei HaTosafot, and the second version that's brought in the Rashbam. Now, the only question is, how does Rav Yehuda deal with the Braita in that case? Because the Braita does use the word higiyo. So what the Balei HaTosafot suggests over here, that Rav Yehuda will say that the higiyo is explaining the case or situation where it was below a shtut, or it was less than a shtut. And he'll read the Braita as saying, Pichet ad shtut, v'yotir ad shtut. Until a shtut, a person added on. Or until a shtut, the person reduced the amount, meaning under a six, the din is higiyo. And it'll be kishuma dayanim, that when it is a sixth, they'll have the same din as above a sixth. And therefore, Rav Yehuda will read the Braita as if it says in it, not pichet shtut or hetir shtut, but the equivalent of saying pichet ad shtut, or hetir ad shtut. And then it's higiyo. And the comparison to Shuma Dayanim is telling you that once you hit a sixth, they'll have the same din as above a sixth. And the fact that you're adding in the words ad, you can see in the previous Tosafot, he discusses that question in the Mishnah as to the language of the Mishnah, who it favors, whether you add in the word ad or you imply the word ad, and whether that is a fair way to read the Mishnah in order to balance between the positions of Rav Yehuda and Rav Huna. On the other hand, the Rashbam has an alternate girsa that does not have the word Ella in it. The way the Bach says is that he thinks the girsa of the Rashbam was Amar Lei Rav Yehuda. That the answer of Rav Huna is that Ulutameich Higiyo Katani. That's the answer of Rav Huna. The word Higiyo is written there, so it's clear that the Braita is not talking about a case of 1/6, because by Shuma Dayanim, the din is that it is Batel Mekach. So the word Higiyo is not relevant over there. And therefore it must be that that case is talking about under a shtut, and that's what it's saying, that the threshold of a shtut is similar both here and Shuma Dayanim, and that means until a shtut, higiyo. Just like by Shuma Dayanim, the transaction stands, so to over here, the transaction will stand. But it's not addressing the issue of a shtut itself. But then we have to flip the question back to Rav Yehuda, because now if it says higiyo, this is a problem for Rav Yehuda to read the Braita. And that's what it says over here, the girsa of the Rashbam is, Amar Lei Rav Yehuda, Kishuma Dayanim Lishtut, Velo Kishuma Dayanim, Dilohot Batel Mekach, Vilohocha Higiyo. He says that the Braita is coming to tell you that it's like Shuma Dayanim, which is that the din of a sixth is the same as above a sixth. On the other hand, the difference between them is that over there, it'll be Batel Mekach. The transaction will be unwound. Over here, the transaction will stand, and you will just refund the excess amount, or the deficit will have to be refunded. So in that case, they have a different din, which is that once you cross a sixth and greater, the din is the same, that there's something wrong now, because a sixth has the same din as above a sixth, but the outcomes will be different. The reason being, and this is what the Rashbam writes, v'hayinahata mainu taima dekeven ta'u beitin. Since Beitin made a mistake in the assessment, chozrim yikol mashasu, we annul everything that they did. Avahocha tarvayu chafitzim b'mecher, both of them want the transaction to go through. Zelim kor v'zelim kach. That one wants to sell, this one wants to buy. Hamekach kayam, and therefore we keep the transaction intact. Vona yachzir, and then you give back the excess amount. And so what Rav Yehuda is explaining to you is, why is the din different over here than it is by the case of Shuma Dayanim? Which is, yes, the din is the same in terms of thresholds. Below a sixth, the din is the same, that it all goes through, the transactions are fine, we don't worry about it at all. A sixth, and then above a sixth, they have the same din, which is there's a problem now. How we solve that problem differs between the two cases. By the case of Shuma Dayanim, we say batel, that it's unwound completely because Beit Din made a mistake, and the owners of the estate don't want, they baked in to act on their behalf in a case where their deviation is that great, then they're going to end up losing money. They're not interested in the sale. The sale was forced upon them because they have to pay for certain expenses, but they didn't want to necessarily sell the property. They're only selling it because they're compelled to. Now that baked in did it on their behalf, they want it to be right. If it's wrong, they want it annulled. On the other hand, in our case, the buyer and seller are willing partners here in the transaction. The only question is the transaction fair because of the deviation from the amount that was specified? So since the transaction involves two willing parties, we're going to keep the transaction alive, and we're just going to adjust it so that it gets back to a fairer level, or the level that they had agreed upon. And therefore, the word higio, according to Rav Yehuda, means not like in our Mishnah higio, the transaction stands, meaning for pachot mishtut, but rather means greater than a shtut. Even in greater than a shtut higio, the transaction stands, you just have to refund the difference. And that's the way that Rav Yehuda will explain the braita. And in this way, according to the Rashbam, both Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda are addressing the braita and explaining it according to their shitot. And the other version that we read it, only Rav Huna is answering the question. And Rav Yehuda, you'll have to answer like the way that the Balei Tosafot would answer. Or you could even answer the way that the Rashbam's Girsa has for Rav Yehuda. He could answer the braita in that way, even though it's not written explicitly in the Gemara. So now we have a case in the Gemara. Rav Papa Zavan Ara Miau Gavra. Rav Papa purchased land from a particular individual, and Rav Papa was very familiar, we're going to see in a second, with the land. He knew exactly where the land was. He knew the features of the land. He knew the production levels of the land. Amar Le Havya Esrin Grive. He said to him that this is a land that has a production level of 20 sa'ah. Mashche, Rav Papa went ahead and measured it out. He checked what the level was. It was only 15. So Rav Papa is purchasing a piece of land which he's very familiar with, and you'll get to understand that from the conversation he's going to have with the buyer in a second. And then the seller had presented to him the facts that this was a field that produced 20 sa'ah. Rav Papa, after the fact, goes and measures, and he sees that it only produces 15 sa'ah. Although the Rashbam does parse the Gemara slightly differently and says that this seller says to Rav Papa, the land that I'm selling you, havya esrim grive mishcha, esrim sa'im midata. It has a area that is the equivalent of 20 sa'ah, and that's true in their expression of area in their day. It had to do with the production of the field we've discussed before. When it says a beit sa'ah, does that mean a beit sa'ah of seeds that would go in there? Does that mean a sa'ah worth of production would come out of this portion of land? But the Rashbam reads the word mishcha as being a part of what the mocher said to Rav Papa. But in the end, they found out that v'lo havi ela chamishra, it was only 15. And so therefore, he claimed he had sold him an area that was an area of 20 beit sa'ot. In the end, it only turned out to be 15 beit sa'ot. So we're going to use the terms interchangeably in terms of whether beit sa'ah means area or production. But it means the same thing in the time of Chazal, but that causes the Rashbam to parse the Gemara instead of saying Mashche that he measured it, v'lo avi ela chamishra, to say that it's Hayasrim Grive Mashche. That was the promised area or midah that he had promised. And then v'lo avi ela chamishra is the result of what they found when he measured it. Atal kameda Abaye comes before his Rebbe Abaye, Amalei, and he wanted Abaye now to paskin on his behalf to say that they have a mekach ta'ot over here. There is a problem in the sale because the seller misrepresented the product that he was buying, the karka that he was buying. So then he says to him, Savart vikibalt, you accepted it. You knew the story of this field. You knew everything about this field. And therefore you accepted what happened in the transaction. You knew, and you accepted it because you paid for it, knowing what the production of the field was. Vahatnan. So Rav Papa says back to him, what about our Mishnah? Our Mishnah says, Pachot mishtut higio, ad shtut inakeh. Our Mishnah says that the threshold for a deviation is 1/6. Over here, we're talking about a 25% deviation, a quarter deviation for what it's supposed to do. So why am I not subject to the Mishnah that says that when you're in excess of a sixth, inakeh, that he has to refund me a portion of the purchase price? So Abaye responds to him and says, Hani mile eched lo kimle bigava. That's only true when the person who's purchased the field doesn't know the field well. But if you know the field well, then you're buying it knowing exactly what's going to happen in the field. So our Mishnah is true when the person sees the field, sees the demarcations, but he doesn't have a good intimate knowledge of the production of the field or what the field does. And therefore, we say that a deviation up to a sixth is normal. Above that is not normal or is not acceptable to people. over here where you knew the field intimately, then you bought it, even though it was misrepresented to you, that misrepresentation doesn't undermine the sale because you accepted it. Knowing and having the knowledge that you had and still purchasing it means that you were willing to accept it as it is. And then the Papa says back to him, buy 3 marmarli. Did they say 20 to me? As the Rashbam explains over here, the claim of Rav Papa is, this is what I thought. When he said to me, it's a field that produces 20 sa'ah, I knew that it only produced 15 sa'ah. But I thought he was going to then add on additional karka to get to the 20 level. He admits to a buyer that he knew that it would only produce 15, but the seller represented that it would produce 20. So what Rav Papa says is, I thought he was going to make up for that differential by providing me with additional karka to get to the 20 level. Amalei da'adifa ke'asrim. Bayez says back to Rav Papa, no, when he said 20, he didn't mean that literally it produces 20 sa'ah. He was basically, as the Rashbam says over here, talking up his game, talking his merchandise. He was trying to sell you his product. And anybody who sells a product tries to tell you that the product is really good. So when he said it produces 20, he didn't literally mean it produces 20. He says the field's like a field that produces 20. And so that's such good quality. It's such a great field. It's as if it produces 20. And so therefore, you can't hold him to that number 20 exactly, because he didn't mean 20 literally. He meant 20 figuratively, which is the quality of the field or the product of the field is like you produce 20 sa'ah. Now, over here, the way that the Rashbam explains it is, Lashbiach mekhol amarkein. He did it simply to talk up the merchandise. And therefore, we're not going to hold him accountable for that number of 20 since you knew that the field produced 15. And therefore, there's no mekach ta'ot. There's no deception that took place over here. When he said 20, he was just trying to tell you that my field's really great. And you who knew it was 15 only paid for it as if it was 15. Based on that, you would have no recourse against the seller. On the other hand, the Red Mama over here says that when he says that it's like 20, then he is standing behind the field that it does produce 20, or it has a higher quality. And therefore, the Yad Rama over here suggests that there better be something special about this field. It can't just be a stam field that produces 15, because then what was he saying when he says, my field's such high quality, it's like it produces 20. So what the Yad Rama seems to indicate is that either the field needs to produce 20, or the field has to produce a higher quality of product, to the fact that he could make a statement figuratively that it's if it gave 20. But if the field is just a regular field that produces 15, then it would be a mekach ta'ot because the seller did represent something over here. Even though Rav Papa knew the production was 15, the seller's representing that it's doing better than 15 something. Either higher quality, maybe in some years it does a bigger number than 15. But he has to substantiate his words. The way the Rashbam reads it, it just looks like you're in the shuk. And guys are bantering back and forth, and he just makes a claim or an exaggerated claim, and we don't hold him to it. On the other hand, the Yad Rama says that there's got to be some substance to that which he said. If there's no substance to which he said, then it would be a mekach ta'ot, and we would unwind the transaction. So now the Gemara is going to move to something that's not related to our sugya at all, but it will eventually bring us back to our sugya. So the Gemara says, Tanya, Rabbi Yossi Omer, Achim Shechalku, brothers who divided a property that they inherited. Kevin Shalak Goral Lechad Mehem, Kana Kulan. Once the Goral falls on one of their lots, then all of them are Koneh. So the way the Rashbam explains over here, if you have two brothers, three brothers, they're dividing up the property of the estate, and now they have subdivided the estate into either two portions or three portions, and now they're going to use a lottery system in order to decide which portion belongs to which of the three brothers that are inheriting the estate. What the Braita says in the name of Rabbi Yossi is that as soon as one of them has picked out his goral, has already picked out his lot, then that locks in the situation as far as the goral is concerned, which is that this person will get his lot. The other two brothers that remain have to split the remaining property. They can either do that through an agreed upon settlement between them, or that they can do it through a goral. But that's left to them. The goral locks in. As you pick out your piece of the goral locks in whoever has picked out the goral to keep whatever property they got through the lottery system. And the remaining parties then are subject, can divide up the remaining property any way they want. If they want to continue to use the goral, that's fine. If they want to come to a settled agreement, that's fine as well. But what they can't do is go back to the original party and say, we want that property back in the settlement. Now that part of it's done. And now you have to move forward. The person who's got that part of the lottery, he's done with his split, and there is no reversing of his position. That's the way that the Rashbam views it. The Rimi Gash brings down a Perush similar to the Rashbam, but then he brings two alternative Perushim over here, mostly to deal with the Kanu Kulam, which is the fact that it sounds like from here, everyone is Kone. The way that the Rashbam is explaining it is that the only thing that is governed by the picking out of that first piece of the lottery is that the person who picked it out has no claim on the remainder of the property, and the remaining brothers have no claim on this piece of property. But the remaining property is still needs to be subdivided amongst the brothers. That doesn't make it sound like Kano Kulam, that they are all now bound by the lottery. And therefore he brings one Perush, which is that as each individual takes their, that after the first one puts his hand into the lottery bowl and picks out his lot, he compels the other brothers that remain to divide the property in a similar manner. What his Kana Kulam means that this is now locking in the mechanism for splitting the property. As soon as one of them has picked out the lottery or started the lottery process, that means that the lottery now becomes the vehicle for the dividing up the property. And nobody can say, no, I want to divide it in a different way. I don't want to use the goral. It locks all the parties into using the goral as the mechanism for dividing up the property. And then he brings a third possibility, which is that the goral is set up in such a way that only one person has to pick out, which is that there's an order of tickets, which basically says that as soon as the person picks out, whatever he gets is what the property he has picked out of the lottery. After him comes Bet, and then after him comes Gimel. And he says that it's an order that's already predetermined as to how the properties will be divided. They line up the brothers and they give them a number of 1, 2, 3. And then they line up the properties and say the properties have this order. And as soon as the individual picks out the property, then you just match up that person with that property and then you finish off the order. And that means that through the picking of the first lottery, everything is determined at that point in time. And that's a third way that he brings down as to explain what it means, Kana Kulam over here. The question is, my time, why does this work? Or why does this force a lock-in? What you're missing here fundamentally is a kinyan. So Amar Rabbi Elazar, Kitchilat Eretz Yisrael, it's the same way that they divided up the land of Israel when the Shvatim were coming into Eretz Yisrael. Matchila bigoral, afkan bigoral. Just like over there, the Shvatim divided up the land of Israel through a lottery system, through a goral. So over here, the goral will work. So the same way that it locked the situation in with regards to the Shvatim and which portions of Eretz Yisrael they would get, so over here, the goral locks in, based on the different explanations that we saw, exactly what it locks in. Where it says, wait a minute, just like over there where they had a lottery bowl and the Urim Vitumim, or in essence it involved HaKadosh Baruch Hu's intervention in this, which is that the Urim Vitumim was used, the Kohen Gadol was matching up properties with other people, and they saw it as a divine division of the land, not simply a random lottery where you're picking it out of a bowl. So that's why maybe over there was binding, is because you have the involvement of the supernatural. Over here, where you have no intervention of a Kodesh Baruch Hu, who says that the parties accept the fact that the Goral is going to be binding? Why should it be the same? Here you have a random lottery versus a lottery that is supposedly giving us what the will of a Kodesh Baruch Hu is. Those are two different things. Amar Rav Ashi. Rashi says, Bawana, the katsaiti lahadode, gamri omaknu lahadode. With the hana'a, that they have come to agreement about how they're going to divide up the property, then they are gomer umakne. They have come to a gemira tadat and allow for the acquisition by each of the parties. So now, there are a couple of things to note over here. The lack of the word Ella when it comes to Ravashi's statement, the Rashbam makes this point very clearly, means that Ravashi is still modifying the answer that we get before. Whenever the Gemara wants to reject an answer that came before and give a completely new answer, it uses the term Ella. So had it said Ella Amar Rav Ashi, Rav Ashi's answer would have been completely different. On the other hand, the fact that it doesn't say the word Ella, as the Rashbam notes over here, that means that we're still keeping the position of Rabbi Elazar, that the paradigm from which we learn is the Goralot in the Midbar. And now Rav Ashi is giving you a way to deal with the Goralot in the Midbar, why the Goral works over here. And the way that the Rashbam expresses it is, Mahani Gmar Data Mim Goral, the Gmira Dat of the individuals to participate in this system of dividing up the land and the Goral is the equivalent Urim Bitumim, the Mahani Afileka Dolo Gamri Umaknu. That works like the Urim Bitumim, even there where it goes against the will of the people. The people didn't have a choice as to whether to use the Goral or to whether the division of the land went their way. They didn't ask the people. It was dictated by a Kodesh Baruch Hu. So over there, the Urim Vitumim and the process of the goral stands in for the gemirat hadat that is normally needed. Because there's divine intervention, because the Kodesh Baruch Hu is dictating where it should go, that goral over there doesn't require gemirat hadat. On the other hand, here, our goral requires gemirat hadat, and so the gemirat hadat will make up for the lack of the urim vitumim. And that's what Rav Ashi is in essence saying. Now, the nafka mina about this might have to do with whether this is only true by a goral, which is that the way that we're reading the Gemara now, Rav Ashi is saying that a goral has a special standing because it was used in Chalukat Aretz. And then we can make up for the deficit of the Urim Vitumim through Gemirat Adat. But that means that this halacha might only be true by a goral. It may not be true in general, because Rav Ashi's statement does not undermine what Rav Elazar said before. There are other Rishonim that have the girsa of Ella Amar Rav Ashi over here. And if you do have that girsa, that means Rav Ashi is rejecting completely the view of Rabbi Elazar before, that the goral is the paradigm by which we learn this din, but rather saying that it has nothing to do with the goral, but rather has to do with the agreement of the parties. Or in essence, what the parties are doing is the equivalent of what would have been in a binding arbitration, which is that if parties accept a certain mechanism for division, their acceptance of that mechanism binds them then to abide by it. And that's what it's saying here, that once you pick out one of the lottery pieces from this system that they have created, that binds all the parties to abide by whatever happened or whatever comes out over there. And we saw before the different views as to what it means when lottery piece is picked out, what is bound or how much is bound by that picking out of the lottery. But obviously, if all the lottery pieces are picked out and all the property has now been divided, that would be a finality to that because of the Gemirat Hadat, that everybody's agreed that this is the mechanism we're going to use. And in that way, it would be the equivalent of binding arbitration, or any agreement for a mechanism of splitting would work. And that's what Rav Ashi is saying, not limited to a goral. It's possible that you could read that even into the other version when you don't have the word Ella and say that goral is just representative of a mechanism for doing this, but if you find any other mechanism, it would work. But many see the difference between the word Ella and not having the word Ella, differentiating between whether this is only true by a goral versus whether it's true in other forms of division. Now, the way that the Gemara ends is that the agreement to use this as a mechanism for division, they are gamre umakne la'adodi, that they are gomirat adat to create a kinyan between them. The problem is, there is no kinyan over here. Or in essence, what we are saying is that the agreement or the consideration of the agreement to divide in that following manner is sufficient to generate a kinyan. And that's the way the Rashbam reads it, that there is a kinyan over here, not a kinyan in the formal sense that we have, but a kinyan that is developed because of the consideration and the agreement between the parties. Almost all the Rishonim read this way, with the exception of what is brought by the Ramah in Shulchan Aruch. The Ramah in Shulchan Aruch, interesting enough, quotes from the Rosh. If you look in the Rosh in our Gemara, the Rosh doesn't say anything like this, but the Pilpa Harift over there notes you should look in the Shuta Rosh, and the Ramah himself is quoting a tshuva of the Rosh. And here he says, in Siman Kufayin Gimel Si'if Bet, the Shulchan Aruch says, Im Chalku Bigoral, Lachar Shalara Goral Echad Mehem, once they divide up through a lottery system or agree to do in such a manner, once one of them picks out the lottery, Nitkaimal Chalukal Kulam, everything's enforced, meaning that the whole thing goes through. There's in fact a kinyan that takes place, the way that the Rashbam explains, the way everybody else explains it over here. The Haggah, the Ramah says, Miwa Rosh Kotav, Viviola Tor, the Tor brings from his father in a tshuva, Deina Goral Koneh, that the Goral itself is not sufficient in order to acquire it. Rak mi varera chalakim. All it does is allows for the assessment of the division of the properties. If one of them then makes a formal kinyan on his property, hachuluka kayemet, then the division stays in place. So basically, the Goral just locks in the way that you divide it. You still need a formal kinyan to have it locked in permanently. So if any one of the parties goes ahead and then makes a kinyan on the property, that will then force all the other parties to abide by the division that was already dictated by the Goral. But the Rosh is not willing to give up the fact that you need a formal kinyan over here. And if you actually look in the Rambam, it's interesting that the Shulchan Aruch paskin similar to the Rambam, which is that there's no need for a kinyan over here. And then you have the Asogot Deraivit over there, and he says, Lo nitchavru divarav. I don't understand what the Rambam is saying over here. The Deraivit is very cryptic in saying, I don't know what he means over here. It's very possible, and the Lechem Mishnah indicates similarly, that the Deraivit is saying the same thing as the Rosh. I don't understand what the Rambam is saying over here, because without a kinyan, you can't have anything locked in. And that's what the Ravid is criticizing the Rambam for, which is, where's the kinyan over here? How can you say that there is a Gemir Dadat? The Lecha Mishnah goes further to say then what do you accomplish by having it locked in? Because without the kinyan, nothing's going to happen. If nothing happens, then what does it mean that you're locked in by the goral? The goral is really not locked in. What locks in the goral is the formalization through a kinyan. So what he suggests over here is that generally you can only make a kinyan on something once the division has been made. What the goral allows you to do is say that the division has been made already, even though they haven't sat down and formally divided the properties or cut the lines, but since they already had agreed that this would be the way they divided up and then they took the lotteries, then the individual goes and machzik in the land, that chazoka will work for him. Even though generally a chazoka only works once the division has been done properly, over here the goral allows for your kinyan to take effect. And that's what it means that the goral is successful or locked in. It's locked in enough to allow the kinyan to be effective over here. That's why the Lecha Mishnah explains that view of the Rosh, but that Rosh throws a monkey wrench in this whole sugya, which seems to indicate that the goral itself is a mechanism for kinyan, and the Rosh says, no, it's just a mechanism for locking in the division, but not the kinyan, and you'd still need a formal kinyan against all the other Rishonim over here, but it's brought by the Ramad in Shulchan Aruch, and therefore it has influence over the halacha in Choshen Mishpat. All right, now the Gemara continues, Itmar, Shnei Achim Shichalku, you have two brothers who divided up property, and all of a sudden a third brother shows up from overseas. They only had knew about the two brothers, or they had no idea what had happened to their third brother. And therefore when the estate came to them, they divided the estate between them, and they never gave a portion to this third brother, either because they didn't know about him, or they didn't think he was alive. All of a sudden he shows up and he says, I want my portion of the estate. So now what do you do once they've already divided up the estate? Rav Amar, batla machloket. You unwind the entire division and you start from scratch again. You got to redo the division because division was done improperly in the first place, and therefore now you have to rectify it by doing a new division. On the other hand, Shmuel Amar Mikamtsin. Shmuel says that you take off a kometz. You break off pieces. The way that the Rashbam explains it over here is that you break off a third from one of the brothers, another third from the other brother. That will then, a third of their property from the one brother, a third of the property from the other brother, that combined amount will give you a third portion, and that third portion would then be given to the third brother. And in that way, since each brother now is giving them a sixth of the total property to this third brother, he will then end up with 2/6 or 1/3 of the property, and the other two brothers also will end up then with the 2/6 remaining of their property, or 1/3 of the property, and now you have an equal division. That's what the Rashbam says Shmuel means, is that you allow the other two brothers to excise a piece of their property and then give it to the third brother. But the Baalei HaTosafot over here are very bothered by this. Why should it be that the two brothers get to determine what the third brother gets? Why is that a fair division of the property? It's one thing if all three brothers divide it up and they have a fair assessment of the three parcels of property, and then you divide it up amongst the brothers. But over here where two brothers already took a portion, and now they're excising a piece of their property and giving it to the third brother, why should the third brother lose out over here? And therefore, they can't understand that explanation in Shmuel's position that the other two brothers get to determine what the third brother gets. And therefore, they believe that Shmuel also believes that you have to redo a goral. You have to redivide the property up into three portions and then throw a goral. And what Shmuel is saying is, mikamsin, is that if they take a goral now, and now if the third portion falls to the new brother that showed up, then the other two remaining positions will be divided between the brothers in the way that they had already divided beforehand. Which is that, yes, we have to restart the goral over here. But in restarting the goral, we will still leave intact what the other two brothers got. So if the third brother gets that third piece entirely, and then there are two pieces left over that belong to each of these brothers before, and it's fair, then those two brothers will keep the pieces that they had before, and that's the end of the goral as soon as the third brother gets his piece. Or, even if the third brother gets a piece which divides it up in a way that was not exactly equal before, nevertheless, we will then try to preserve at least what was from the original goral belonging to the other two brothers when they go to divide the remaining property. And we will keep as much as possible of the original division intact. The Rimi Gash over here again has a middle shita, which is that he thinks like the Rashbam, that it's up to the two brothers to give to the third brother whatever it is, but he says that's only with the acquiescence of the third brother. The third brother has to accept the fact that they're going to give him the property, and he has to be happy with whatever they have given him. So he has a veto right over this. And so what Shmuel is saying is, if the third brother agrees, then they can give him a piece of the property and leave everything intact. If the third brother doesn't agree and he wants a whole new division of the property, in Ochanami, then we would force a whole new redivision of the property. So Amarle Rova the Rav Nachman. So Rova says to Rav Nachman, the Rav Damar Batla Machloket, according to Rav who says that we unwind the division completely, Alma Hodor Dina. From this you see that when there's a division that is done and we're not happy with the division, you would unwind the division. Elamiato. Hana Beit Lato de Kaime. If you have three individuals who are engaged in a partnership of some sort, that means, according to the Rashbam, it doesn't matter whether they are brothers, whether they are shutafin, whether it's karka, whether it's metaltlin, it doesn't matter what is involved over here. Vazo Beit Remi Nayu Poluk. And two of the partners or two of the brothers go ahead and subdivide the property. They say, we want out of this partnership, we want out of this relationship. Then we allow them to go and divide it. Hochanami de Batla Machloket. You're going to say in Ochanami there that we have to unwind it because the third party wasn't present when two out of the three partners went ahead and dissolved the partnership. So the assumption of the Gemara clearly is that that does work, because otherwise how could the Gemara ask a question from something when they don't know the din? It's clear here that the Gemara believes that you can have a dissolution of a partnership even without the presence of all the parties. And that's what the Rashbam says over here. You can prove that from the Gemara in Bava Metzia with Isoguria and Rav Safra, that over there you saw that there is an ability to divide up or dissolve a partnership as long as it's done under the proper protocol, which means that if they go to Beit Din and they have a Beit Din that looks at this and assesses the fact that this is an equal distribution of the assets of the partnership, then it's fine. You can go ahead and dissolve the partnership, give the two partners who are present their piece, and then the third partner will have to come when he comes back, take whatever's left over, the piece that was left for him, because there was a proper and equal division of the property. That's what the Rashbam says is the halacha, and therefore the Gemara is now asking on Rav, who says over here, where you had two brothers that divided a property, the third brother wasn't present. When he comes back, why can't you just subdivide the property and give the third brother what he deserves? Why do you have to dissolve the division that was done beforehand? Now, the answer to the question is obvious, and then we'll come back again and discuss other opinions over here. Where it says, Achiashto, how can you compare the cases? When they dissolved the partnership, they knew there were three partners. So when they subdivided the assets, they divided up the assets in a manner which gave each partner an equal share in it. So the original dissolution or division of the property was done for three. Over here, when they subdivided the property, they did it originally with only thinking there were two. They didn't know about the third party, so the division was a division of two and not a division of three. And therefore, the cases are completely different, which is that in a case where you know all the partners and you divide it equally between the partners, then even without the acquiescence of one of the partners, the other partners have a right to dissolution. As long as it's done in front of a Beit Din, it's done in a fair manner, any one of the partners that wants out can get out of the partnership without any problem. And that's what the Gemara is asking on Rav from. And the Gemara answers that Rav's case is different. Rav's case is a case where he didn't know about the other party, and therefore it wasn't done equally between the three parties. It was done equally between the two parties. The introduction of the third party is what causes us to undermine the division. Had you known about the third party and divided equally in Ochanami, it would have been just fine. And again here, the Balei Tosafot disagree with the Rashbam and say that he's not right. There is no dissolution of a partnership without all the parties being present. You can't create the subdivisions, you can't do the assessments, but you will have to throw a lottery when the third guy shows up to split it up between the three individuals. You can't say the two individuals say we walk off with our pieces, and then the third guy gets whatever it is when he gets back here. That's not fair. You have to start fresh when the third guy shows up, and you will then take a lottery that binds all of them. And what the Balei Tosafot say over here, similar to their previous explanation, that when the first two parties threw a goral between them and then took lots there, and the third guy comes back, then have to restart again with a new goral. But if it turns out that he got one piece and the remaining two pieces are then available for these two individuals, they'll have to divide it like the way they did previously under the first goral that was thrown. And then they go to undermine the position of the Rashbam, who brought a proof from Bava Metzia to the fact that you can divide or dissolve a partnership even without the agreement of the parties. And they say over here, there's a big difference. Over there was dealing with kesef. It was dealing with money. The subdivision of money is very easy because money has inherent worth to it or is easily divisible. You just count out the number and then you can divide it between the parties. Over there, of course, you can dissolve the partnership without the other party because you can't force the parties to stay in the partnership. If they want to subdivide and it's talking about money or metaltalin, Those are items that you can divide up equally and have no problem. On the other hand, when you're talking about property, property is something where the location of the property, the nature of the property, the way you divide the property, all of those are influential in the value. And therefore, you can't subdivide the properties or distribute the properties to the partners without the agreement of all the partners. Therefore, they say our case over here is different, and it would not be fair to dissolve the properties without all of the partners being there. And again, they explained it similar to the way they did above, which was that there were two lotteries that were thrown. The original lottery to divide it up for the two partners, and then a new lottery again when the third partner showed up to redivide it, and then the original lottery would be binding on the first two partners once the third partner takes his share in the new lottery. Though in the end, the Balei Tosafot do come back to the defense of the Reshbam because they prove from other places that you can't divide up property, and they suggest that maybe there's a difference in the division of property between willing dividers of property versus imposed dividers of property. And what they suggest is that the Gemarot that say that you can't divide property without the acquiescence of the partners is only a case when you're dealing with Yitomim, when you're dealing with all Ktanim, and therefore the Beit Din is acting on behalf of the Yitomim, but the Yitomim themselves have no necessarily interest or don't necessarily have to divide up the property. It's all being imposed by the Beit Din. In that case, later on, the Yitomim can come back and make a claim, why did you divide it this way? I would have divided it this way, and they can undermine the whole division. But in a case where you have a Gadol, we have someone who's asking for the dissolution of the partnership, maybe the Reshbam is right that even by Karka, you could demand a dissolution of the partnership. And so in the end, the Balei Tosafot bring evidence of the fact that maybe the Reshbam is correct with regards to property, which would then take us back to the original explanation over here, which is that you can demand a dissolution of the partnership even if all the partners are not present. The Rimi Gash over here also has a different explanation of the Gemara and says that this Hani Blei Tlato is almost identical to the case of Achin Shechalku before, which is a case where two of the Shutfim divided up the property between them, and then when the third Shutaf came back, you do not undermine the original division of the estate or the division of the shutafut, but rather they cut off a piece and give it to that third party. And therefore, it would be almost identical to the case that we saw before. But over here, the outcome of the case or the psak seems to be that you maintain the original division and then you just cut off a piece and give it to the third party. And that would be exactly like Shmuel's position there and not like Rab's position. And then, of course, the answer of the Gemara would be then that there's a difference between the cases, which is over there, they did not anticipate the third party, so they didn't know they were going to have to slice off a piece and give it to the third party. But over here, when they divided it between the two of them, they knew up front that they were going to also have to now subdivide that later and give a portion of each of their properties of the shutavut to get the third partner paid out when he came back. So now Rav Papa says to Abaye, Shmuel damar mikamtsin. According to Shmuel, says that you're allowed to, according to the Reshbam, slice off a piece of the property and give it to the third brother. And going to the Balei Tosafot and the Rimi Gash, the other explanations we saw, the Memra, the Kamdino. From that you would say that once a division is made, the division is binding, and you don't unwind the division. Vaha Ravu Shmuel Damrei Tarvayu. Then we have the din of Rav and Shmuel, which we saw yesterday, and we saw in Bava Metzia as well, that here the important part is Shmuel that says it, Kor B'Shloshim, Ani Mocher Lecha. If I'm going to sell a Kor, which is Shloshim Sa'a, for 30 sela, yecholak zorba afilu b'sahachrona. He's able to reverse the transaction until he's given him the full quantity. Kor b'shloshim, if he says to him, I'm giving you a kor for 30 sela, sa'a b'sela, ani mocher lecha, and then he defines it and says that each sa'a goes for a sela, that's how I'm selling to you, rishon rishon kana. As he gives him each one of the items, then the transaction is closed for that item. So the question is on Shmuel, where over here he says once a division is done, once a transaction begins and you start to give over whatever it is that belongs to this division, that locks it in place. Yet over here, when it comes to the mechira, it comes to the sale, he's selling him 30 sa'ah, a total kor, and he's saying this is the price for the total kor. Why, when he starts to give it over to him, does that not lock in that division, lock in already that transaction as he is giving it to him? Because as long as a person is taking something that really does belong to them, it should belong to them, we assume that it comes into their possession. Just like by the case of the property, since this was something that did belong to them, the property that did come into their possession that did belong to them remains there and we don't unwind it. So similarly over here, where the product or produce that is being given over to him is produce that he should be getting, as he gets it, he should be able to keep it and lock in the transaction for those items. Where his answer is, wait a minute, the cases are different. You have to differentiate between the cases. When it comes to transactions, the Chachamim look to institute principles that will be to the benefit of both parties. Over here, where he says that I'm buying a full quantity, both the buyer and the seller want rights of retraction over there. Because if the price goes up, the seller wants a right of retraction. If the price goes down, the buyer wants a right of retraction. Therefore, both parties are interested in that right of retraction, and therefore the Chachamim preserve that right of retraction. Aval gabi chalukat hakarka, when you come into the division of land, badai nechalu li pater maher zemizeh, by the dissolution of a partnership or of brothers in an estate, the fact that they want to divide it already means that the more expedient we are in dividing up the property, the better it is. And that is because, as the Rashbam says, each person will get his portion, and then he can fix it up, he can invest in it, he can do whatever it is. That when you have a pot that belongs to partners, it never gets hot and never gets cold, meaning that there is this diffusion of responsibility. So the problem in the partnership is this diffusion of responsibility. Now that they've decided on the dissolution of the partnership, each party wants to get to whatever it is that they need as fast as possible so they can start investing and doing whatever it is to improve the karka. Because as long as it remains together, the property is not going to be invested in properly, is not going to be taken care of properly by the nature of the fact that it is a partnership, especially a partnership where the partners want to dissolve the partnership. Therefore, yokach kamdina. Therefore, over there, Chazal decided that the din should be that it's done, what is done is done. And therefore, whatever the division is, that's done so that the parties can then begin to move on from their partnership. By the case of the transaction, both parties are interested in the ability to retract. And so therefore, the din is different by a transaction for mitaltalim rather than a dissolution of a partnership. Okay, we're going to stop here by the second line on the top of Kuf Zayin Omid Aleph.